The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2014. Here's books editor Claire Armitstead.
Hello and welcome to the Edinburgh Books Podcast. Today's guest sprang from nowhere last year as a fully formed thing. Excuse the bad joke, but she was asking for it when she called her novel A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. She's Emma McBride, and she's won a bevy of prizes, including the Bailey's Award for Women's Fiction, in which she beat no less a person than Donna Tartt into second place, or we gather second place. Also here to provide a bit of context is critic at large Stuart Kelly, who among other things was one of last year's Man Booker judges. Stuart, this is almost an anti-published novel, isn't it? I have here an item which will no doubt become a collector's item, which is a proof of this novel, and it's absolutely white. It has no sell on it whatsoever. I didn't even know what it was when it arrived through the letterbox to begin with, and yet here it's gone on to this amazing future.
Yes, I mean, it's an astonishing piece of work, and I quite like the bravery of putting out a book with no flim-flam and puffery round about it. I mean, I don't know if it's just being a contrarian Scot, but when I get a press release through, it just strikes me as being a list of adjectives I'm not going to use in the review.
It's a pretty harrowing tale, but to say it's the story of a damaged girl doesn't actually give anything away about what it actually is, because the whole thing exists in the writing of it. I was wondering whether you would read us a short extract to give people who are not yet familiar with it some idea of what I'm talking about.
I met a man, I let him throw me round the bed and smoked me, spliffs and choked my neck until I said I was dead. I met a man who took me for walks, long ones in the country. I offer up in the hedge. I met a man I met with her, she and me and his friend to bars at night and drink champagne and bought me chips at every tea time. I met a man with condoms in his pockets. Don't use them. He loves children in his heart. No. I met a man who knew me once, who saw me around when I was a child, who said, "You're a fine looking woman now." Who said, "Come back, marry me, live on my farm." No. I met a man who was a priest. I did. Just as well as many another one would. I met a man, who said he'd pay me by the month, who said he'd keep me up in style, and I'd be waiting when he arrived. No, is what I said. I met a man who hit me a smack. I met a man who cracked my arm. I met a man who said, "What are you doing out so late at night?" I met a man. And wash my mouth out with soap, I wish I could. That I did then. I met a man, a stupid thing. I met a man, should have turned on my heel, I thought. I didn't know to think. I didn't even know to speak. I met a man, I kept on walking. I met a man, and I lay down, and slapped and cried and whined and dined. I met a man, and many more, and I didn't know you at all.
Well, a glimpse there of what led Anne Enright to describe you in The Guardian as that old-fashioned thing, a genius, in that she writes truth-spilling, uncompromising and brilliant prose that can be, on occasion, quite hard to read. Stuart, you're a bit of an expert on the quite hard to read. Is this a true description?
Well, what I've always said about the novel is that the greatest novels are the novels which change the form of the novel itself. And I think A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing does this. You know, this is a radically new departure in some ways. It's a novel where the reader has to infer a lot. And yes, I do like difficult books. I do like readers to be challenged. And I think there's both an emotional core to that and an intellectual part to it. I mean, when I've been telling friends about this book, I've been saying the whole time it's Anne Enright's subject matter, but rewritten by Gertrude Stein. And it has that kind of cadence that I associate with Stein, the lacunae and the ellipses. And I don't even know if Emma's read any Stein.
I have, but not any of the difficult ones.
They're all difficult ones.
Can I just stop you there? Because you made a really interesting point, which is it's been likened to Joyce a lot, and you can see that passage is sort of a bit Molly Bloomish, really, isn't it? But, Stuart, you made the point that actually it's a modernism of ellipses rather than of sort of ramble.
Of exuberance. Yes,
and
I do associate the modernism of ellipses with a writer like Stein, or perhaps even a writer like Woolf. You know, with Woolf, what she's thinking and what she's thinking are actually two different things. You know, you get the voice in the head that's almost covering up what the real motivations and aches and angsts and heartfelt emotions are. You know, I love Joyce for its exuberance. I love Finnegan's Wake. I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the most exuberant books that's ever been. But the other kinds of modernisms, I think, are just as important. And, you know, we haven't really gone into all the ways in which these different kinds of modernisms might be applied to our contemporary life, our contemporary fiction.
There's also a bit of Burroughs in it, isn't there? It's sort of cut up, only it's cut up consciousness rather than... I mean, would you accept that?
Not really for me, I have to say. I've never read any Burroughs, so unfortunately I can't claim that one.
And I always think of Burroughs as more of a surreal writer. I mean, the way that he chopped the pages up and rearranged them so you'd get strange combinations of words almost produced in an aleatory sort of subconscious fashion. But, you know, as I say, there are lots and lots of different modernisms and we don't use enough of them.
There's something that you do that I found really challenging, and I keep on going on thinking about it, which is that you're incredibly close, you're very close to the experience. You're so close to the experience of what she's going through that you wonder if it exists outside memory, it exists in the present moment. And yet then it actually is also a remembered thing. One particular incident sums this up for me, which is when she meets her uncle on the stairs and she says, "He didn't do it." "Oh yes, he did." So it's both an experience as he's coming down the stairs, and it's something that she remembers that relates to another experience.
Yes, I suppose that's right. But really, you know, that passage particularly was for me about working out what would happen next in the novel, and that's really a very technical thing that I decided to leave in because it seemed to embody that so well. And the idea that, you know, while most of it is happening right in that very moment, there are occasional sentences in which the girl refers to it as being in the past, and I suppose that was to allow for the fact that it was told, it was written down, it did not just exist in her head.
At the centre of it is the relationship, her relationship with her brother, who has had an operation as a very small child to have a brain tumour removed. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was very interested in exploring that. It was an experience I grew up with myself. One of my older brothers had a childhood brain tumour, and while the book is, you know, work fiction, it's not about him. I was keen to have a look at the experience of living with the disabilities of a sibling, of a beloved sibling particularly. And so that relationship really became the core of the novel, although it wasn't what I had originally set out to do or to write about.
It's a novel with a beginning and an end, a pretty terrible end, but it doesn't have a plot in a conventional way. What's your attitude towards plotting?
I'm not at all interested in plotting. I'm very interested in story, and the book is the story of someone's life, and that doesn't necessarily, you know, function neatly in terms of plot. And so it was something really that I ignored. Obviously things have to happen, but I wanted everything to progress, you know, as a natural consequence of the things that had gone before, and that was the only plot that I had any interest in.
Stuart, do you accept that distinction between plot and story?
Broadly, yes. I mean, I think it almost goes back to Robert Louis Stevenson's little piece of humble remonstrance that he writes to Henry James, where he talks about life being illogical, chaotic, unfinished, and art being perfect, finished, complete, intact. And, you know, that distinction between the two ways of approaching how we address reality, you can see it rumbling through the whole of the 20th century. Do we best describe reality when we describe it as sort of inchoate, or when we impose some kind of plot on it? And, you know, somebody like Thomas Pynchon, I think, is very much the person who puts plot over chaos. And somebody like Beckett, perhaps, allows the chaos just to exist as is. I mean, there's always a tension in the arts, and what I don't like is coming down on one side or the other. You know, you can have people who do perfect, intricate, beautiful, clockwork little plottings, somebody like Georges Perec's Life of User's Manual, and at the same time there is this kind of formless, which can be every bit as precise, every bit as accurate. I mean, I'm still staggered that the novel can do so many new things.
It's a very musical novel, as we heard in that extract that you read. And I wonder to what extent you see yourself as part of an Irish tradition. Stuart mentioned Beckett, who's the obvious person. It conjures.
Linguistically, obviously, it's very influenced by Irish vernacular. And in some ways, you know, I think Yeats is very important to me, was very important to my attitude to language when I was growing up. It was all around me because I grew up a lot of the time in Sligo. And while, you know, I'm not particularly interested in poetry itself or writing it, using language in that way and is something that I'm interested in doing, and I suppose Yeats certainly was part of that.
But Joyce as well, obviously. I mean, Joyce is clearly good. He's kind of the granddaddy of us all now, isn't he?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, without him I do not exist.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Stuart, you have chaired Will Self
recently
for his new novel, which is not yet published. I haven't read it. I did, however, read his previous one, Umbrella. It had sentences that flow from one thought into another thought, from one person's head into another person's head, in the course of the same sentence. Is this something very different to what Emer's doing, or do they belong to the same tradition?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, what Will is interested in is where consciousnesses seg into other consciousnesses. It's sort of breaking down the membranes between ourselves. However, stylistically, there's a lot of similarities. You know, Will is... Shark, the new novel, opens with somebody shaving, you know, just like Buck Mulligan at the beginning of Ulysses. It ends with part of a sentence which is completed by the first sentence of the book, so it has that kind of Ouroboros structure like Finnegan's Wake. And I'm very interested that, you know, Will, Emer, quite a few other authors seem to be going back to the modernist greats and saying, okay, what else can we get out of this? I mean, I think that's far more important for the novel than just whether or not your novel's got a selfie in it or uses the word amazeballs. You know, that seems to be a fairly low kind of engagement with the contemporary compared to going back to these modernist giants and saying, okay, what can they allow us to do that we couldn't do before? And there's still lessons to be learned there.
Tell us a little bit more about your central character and how she experiences herself.
You know, she's a girl growing up in the 80s and the early 90s in Ireland, and that's very, although it's never explicitly stated in the novel, it's very important to who she is and the things that form her, and, you know, the Catholic Church and very conservative society that surrounds her. And so I wanted really to try and write the story from the inside of her as well, so that the reader would experience what it was to be her as opposed to think of her.
It certainly does that, and I've rarely come across a novel where I was so scared for the character. You know, you knew she was going to make a mistake and you were utterly powerless to stop it. I found that absolutely fascinating. I mean, I've rarely had a book where I kind of kept on putting it down thinking, I just don't really want this to happen now. You know, I can't go on with that. Can I ask you though, I mean, she's nameless in the book, significantly nameless.
Yeah.
Did you have a name yourself for her?
No, and to me she's the girl. She's still the girl.
One name that came up during your discussion on stage was R.D. Lang. Tell us a bit about how he fits in and this particular psychological approach fits in.
Well, you know, R.D. Lang's... There seems to be a slight renaissance in thinking about R.D. Lang. Both Dilys Rose, who was on the stage with us earlier, and, you know, Will Self, it quite explicitly states in Shark that Zach Bussner has been inspired by R.D. Lang's experiments in communal living between patients and doctors. In a nutshell, Lang's theory is that people aren't mad, the world is. And it's a far more patient-centred form of therapy. He's also interested in the way in which families distort the people in it, and I think that fits very much with Emer's book, that the relationship with the mother, the absent father, the damaged brother, the abusive uncle, you know, all these different power relationships are what are distorting and altering the girl's psychology. But, you know, obviously Will has talked a lot about Lang, and Lang's a central presence in the book. And again, it's novel does have a moral duty almost to make us confront the radical difference of other people. And, you know, that's what Emma's book, that's what Will's book does absolutely brilliantly. You're absolutely confronted with the reality of people who are unlike you.
Is this a conscious thing that you do, Emma?
No, I don't think it was. What I wanted to do was to give a reader someone's life to look at as entirely as possible, to allow them into parts of another human being that they may never experience so intimately, that is impossible to experience in any other way. And I think that's something that the novel can do that nothing else can do. And so the novel has plenty of steam left in it.
So explain the title.
Well, it has two meanings. One is, you know, a girl is a half-formed thing and a woman is a fully formed thing. And the book is about her attempts to become, and all throughout she's striving to become and to become a woman. And then the use of the word thing is there because so much of it is about objectification and how the girl comes to objectify herself. And I think thing is a very powerful word to use in connection to anyone, and to use in connection to entire gender is something I wanted to do.
Famously, it took 9 years to get published. You submitted it to loads and loads of publishers. No one would have it. Why do you think they were so reluctant?
They were nervous about the style and feeling that they wouldn't be able to sell it. And certainly that's what the rejection letters came back with, was that it didn't fit into any recognisable niche. And I even had a publisher suggest that if I would say it was a memoir, then that might be a way forward, which was a terrible position to be put in, frankly, and a terrible position to ask a writer to put themselves in.
So they were saying they could sell it as a misery memoir, but they couldn't sell it as a piece of truthful fiction.
I think so, and I think obviously, you know, the memoir is kind of the monster of literature at the moment, and somehow it's perceived that it is more authentic. And also, I suppose it keys the publisher into the reader much more quickly and readily, and they feel that they have more authenticity if they can say it's a memoir.
I just find that monstrously disappointing. I've always thought that not being in a niche is where the novel sits most comfortably. That, you know, when things are breaking the rules, when things are not doing what has gone before, then the novel is being what it says on the tin, novel. And, you know, the fact that we're getting this kind of cloned fiction where it's just, you know, a novel we've had before, but you throw in a few mobile phones, it's dispiriting.
Or indeed a misery memoir, because I mean, this is a misery story, isn't it? Except for that, if you describe it as that, as I said at the beginning, you're taking away what it is. What it is its style.
Yeah, I hope it's not any kind of contribution to misery lit. And certainly when I was writing it, I was very anxious about falling into that sort of tradition of Irish miserabilism, and I wanted to steer clear of that. But there are big themes that are important to Irish writers for a reason, and sometimes you can't escape them, so it has to be in the handling where you make the difference.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.